Chapter 22. Reason with me, Mr. Darrow. There are feelings that go deeper than facts. And I know she thought of studying for the stage. Madame de Chantel raised the corner of her lace handkerchief to her eyes. I'm old-fashioned like my furniture, she murmured. And I thought I could count on you, Mr. Darrow. When Darrow, that night, regained his room, he reflected with a flash of irony that each time he entered it, he brought a fresh troop of perplexities to trouble its serene seclusion. Since the day after his arrival, only 48 hours before, when he had set his window open to the night, and his hopes had seemed as many as its stars, each evening had brought its new problem and its renewed distress. But nothing, as yet, had approached the blank misery of mind with which he now set himself to face the fresh questions confronting him. Sophie Viner had not shown herself at dinner, so that he had had no glimpse of her in her new character, and no means of divining the real nature of the tie between herself and Owen Leath. One thing, however, was clear. Whatever her real feelings were, and however much or little he had at stake, if he had made up her mind to marry Owen, he had more than enough skill and tenacity to defeat any arts that poor Madame de Chantel could oppose to her. Darrow himself was in fact the only person who might possibly turn her from her purpose. Madame de Chantel, at haphazard, had hit on the surest means of saving Owen, if to prevent his marriage were to save him. Darrow, on this point, did not pretend to any fixed opinion. One feeling alone was clear and insistent in him. He did not mean, if he could help it, to let the marriage take place. How he was to prevent it, he did not know. To his tormented imagination, every issue seemed closed. For a fantastic instant, he was moved to follow Madame de Chantel's suggestion and urge Anna to withdraw her approval. If his reticence, his efforts to avoid the subject, had not escaped her, as he had doubtless set them down to the fact of his knowing more, and thinking less, of Sophie Viner than he had been willing to admit, and he might take advantage of this to turn her mind gradually from the project. Yet how do so without betraying his insincerity? If he had had nothing to hide, he could easily have said, it's one thing to know nothing against the girl, it's another to pretend that I think her a good match for Owen. But could he say even so much without betraying more? It was not Anna's questions, or his answers to them, that he feared, but what might cry aloud in the intervals between them. He understood now that ever since Sophie Viner's arrival at Giver, he had felt in Anna the lurking sense of something unexpressed, and perhaps inexpressible, between the girl and himself. When at last he fell asleep, he had fatalistically committed his next step to the chances of the morrow. The first that offered itself was an encounter with Mrs. Leath as he descended the stairs the next morning. As he had come down already hatted and shod for a dash to the park lodge, where one of the gatekeeper's children had had an accident. In her compact dark dress she looked more than usually straight and slim, and her face wore the pale glow it took on at any call on her energy. A kind of warrior brightness that made her small head, with its strong chin and close-bound hair, like that of an Amazon in a frieze. It was their first moment alone since he had left him, the afternoon before, at her mother-in-law's door, and after a few words about the injured child their talk inevitably reverted to Owen. Anna spoke with a smile of her scene with Madame de Chantel, who belonged, poor dear, to a generation when scenes in the ladylike and lacrimal sense of the term were the tribute which sensibility was expected to pay to the unusual. Their conversation had been, in every detail, so exactly what Anna had foreseen that it had clearly not made much impression on her, but she was eager to know the result of Darrow's encounter with her mother-in-law. She told me she'd sent for you. She always sends for people in emergencies. That again, I suppose, is the lepic. And failing Adelaide Painter, who can't get here till this afternoon, there was no one but poor you to turn to. She put it all lightly, with a lightness that seemed to his tight-strung nerves slightly, undefinably overdone. but he was so aware of his own tension that he wondered, the next moment, whether anything would ever again seem to him quite usual, and insignificant and in the common order of things. As they hastened on through the drizzle in which the storm of the night was weeping itself out, Anna drew close under his umbrella, and at the pressure of her arm against his he recalled his walk up the Dover Pier with Sophie Viner. The memory gave him a startled vision of the inevitable occasions of contact, confidence, familiarity, which his future relationship to the girl would entail, and the countless chances of betrayal that every one of them involved. "Do tell me just what you said," he heard Anna pleading, and with sudden resolution he affirmed, "I quite understand your mother-in-law's feeling as she does." The words, when uttered, seemed a good deal less significant than they had sounded to his inner ear, and Anna replied without surprise, "Of course. It's inevitable that she should. But we shall bring her round in time." Under the dripping dome she raised her face to his. "Aunt, you remember what you said the day before yesterday? Together we can't fail to pull it off for him. I've told Owen that, so you're pledged, and there's no going back." The day before yesterday. Was it possible that, no longer ago, life had seemed a sufficiently simple business for a sane man to hazard such assurances? "Anna," he questioned her abruptly, "why are you so anxious for this marriage?" She stopped short to face him. But surely I've explained to you, or rather I've hardly had to, you seem so in sympathy with my reasons." "I didn't know, then, who it was that Owen wanted to marry." The words were out with a spring and he felt a clearer air in his brain. But her logic hemmed him in. "You knew yesterday, and you assured me then, that you hadn't a word to say against Miss Viner?" The name, once uttered, sounded on and on in his ears. "Of course not. But that doesn't necessarily imply that I think her a good match for Owen." Anna made no immediate answer. When she spoke it was to question, "Why don't you think her a good match for Owen?" "Well, Madame de Chantel's reasons seem to me not quite as negligible as you think." "You mean the fact that she's been Mrs. Murrett's secretary, and that the people who employed her before were called Oak? For, as far as Owen and I can make out, these are the gravest charges against her. Still, one can understand that the match is not what Madame de Chantel had dreamed of." "Oh, perfectly if that's all you mean." The lodge was in sight, and as he hastened her step, he strode on beside her in silence, but at the gate she checked him with the question, "Is it really all you mean?" "Of course," he heard himself declare. "Oh, then I think I shall convince you, even if I can't, like Madame de Chantel, summon all the Everards to my aid." She lifted to him the look of happy laughter that sometimes brushed her with a gleam of spring. Darrow watched her hasten along the path between the dripping chrysanthemums and enter the lodge. After as he had gone in, he paced up and down outside in the drizzle, waiting to learn if as he had any message to send back to the house. And after the lapse of a few minutes she came out again. "The child," she said, "was badly, though not dangerously, hurt, and the village doctor, who was already on hand, had asked that the surgeon, already summoned from Franchuel, should be told to bring with him certain needful appliances. Owen had started by motor to fetch the surgeon, but there was still time to communicate with the latter by telephone. The doctor furthermore begged for an immediate provision of such bandages and disinfectants as Giver itself could furnish, and Anna bade Darrow address himself to Miss Viner, who would know where to find the necessary things, and would direct one of the servants to bicycle with them to the lodge. Darrow, as he hurried off on this errand, had at once perceived the opportunity it offered of a word with Sophie Viner. What that word was to be he did not know. But now, if ever, was the moment to make it urgent and conclusive. It was unlikely that he would again have such a chance of unobserved talk with her. He had supposed he should find her with her pupil in the schoolroom, but he learned from a servant that Effie had gone to Franchuel with her stepbrother, and that Miss Viner was still in her room. Darrow sent her word that he was the bearer of a message from the lodge, and a moment later he heard her coming down the stairs. XX, for a second, as she approached him, the quick tremor of her glance showed her all intent on the same thought as himself. He transmitted his instructions with mechanical precision, and she answered in the same tone, repeating his words with the intensity of attention of a child not quite sure of understanding. Then she disappeared up the stairs. Darrow lingered on in the hall, not knowing if she meant to return, yet inwardly sure she would. At length he saw her coming down in her hat and jacket. The rain still streaked the window panes, and, in order to say something, he said, "You're not going to the lodge yourself? I've sent one of the men ahead with the things, but I thought Mrs. Leaf might need me." "She didn't ask for you," he returned, wondering how he could detain her, but she answered decidedly, "Colin, I'd better go." He held open the door, picked up his umbrella, and followed her out. As they went down the steps, she glanced back at him. "Ooh, I've forgotten your Macintosh. I shan't need it." As he had no umbrella, and he opened his, and held it out to her. She rejected it with a murmur of thanks, and walked on through the thin drizzle, and he kept the umbrella over his own head, without offering to shelter her. Rapidly and in silence they crossed the court, and began to walk down the avenue. They had traversed a third of its length before Darrow said abruptly, "Colin, wouldn't it have been fairer, when we talked together yesterday, to tell me what I've just heard from Mrs. Leaf?" "Fairer?" She stopped short with a startled look. "If I'd known that your future was already settled, I should have spared you my gratuitous suggestions." She walked on, more slowly, for a yard or two. "Couldn't speak yesterday. I meant to have told you today. Oh, I'm not reproaching you for your lack of confidence. Only, if you had told me, I should have been more sure of your really meaning what you said to me yesterday." She did not ask him to what he referred, and he saw that her parting words to him lived as vividly in her memory as in his. "Is it so important that you should be sure?" she finally questioned. "Not to you, naturally," he returned with involuntary asperity. It was incredible, yet it was a fact, that for the moment his immediate purpose in seeking to speak to her was lost under a rush of resentment at counting for so little in her fate. Of what stuff, then, was his feeling for her made? A few hours earlier as he had touched his thoughts as little as his senses, but now he felt old sleeping instincts stir in him. A rush of rain dashed against his face, and, catching Sophie's hat, strained it back from her loosened hair. She put her hands to her head with a familiar gesture. He came closer, and held his umbrella over her. At the lodge he waited, while she went in. The rain continued to stream down on him, and he shivered in the dampness, and stamped his feet on the flags. It seemed to him that a long time elapsed before the door opened and she reappeared. He glanced into the house for a glimpse of Anna, but obtained none, yet the mere sense of her nearness had completely altered his mood. The child, Sophie told him, was doing well, but Mrs. Leaf had decided to wait till the surgeon came. Darrow, as they turned away, looked through the gates, and saw the doctor's old-fashioned carriage by the roadside. "Let me tell the doctor's boy to drive you back," he suggested. But Sophie answered, "Colin, no, I'll walk," and he moved on toward the house at her side. She expressed no surprise at his not remaining at the lodge, and again they walked on in silence through the rain. As he had accepted the shelter of his umbrella, but she kept herself at such a carefully measured distance that even the slight swaying movements produced by their quick pace did not once bring her arm in touch with his, and, noticing this, he perceived that every drop of her blood must be alive to his nearness. "What I meant just now," he began, "was that you ought to have been sure of my good wishes." She seemed to weigh the words. "You were enough for what?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.